today on Against the Grain: exclusion, discrimination, internment, racist violence. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have gone through a lot in the U.S., but their situation and their struggles haven't always attracted the attention they deserve. Karen Ishizuka has written a book about Asian American movement history. It's called Serve the People: Making Asian America in the Long 60s. I'm CS. Karen Ishizuka will discuss her book and some of the political struggles it covers, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. To say that Asian lives matter, well, that might sound a bit weird given how attuned many on the left are to the situation and plight of African Americans. Latinos and Latinas also get a lot of attention, while Asians, well, they're not talked about very much, in part because many people don't see Asian Americans or Pacific Islanders as an oppressed group. The effort to make Asian lives matter to the U.S. public, to address discrimination and racist violence against the API population, has thus been a difficult one, but there have been successes, and a great deal of energy and countless sacrifices have gone into Asian American activism over the years. Shining a light on that activism and those sacrifices is what Karen Ishizuka has done in her latest book. It's called Serve the People: Making Asian America in the Long 60s. Karen Ishizuka is an award-winning documentary film producer who is part of the Asian American movement in Los Angeles. She helped establish the Japanese American National Museum, and she received her PhD from UCLA. When Karen Ishizuka joined me recently, I asked what she was trying to accomplish with her book.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, at this point in time, the term Asian American is so widely used, indiscernibly, I think, that it had lost its original concept of a political identity. And at this point, there's just so much, you know, Asian American this, Asian American journalists, Asian American social workers, Asian American psychologists, that it has become more of an adjective, you know, an ethnic identifier than a point of view, which it was always meant to be. So at this point, I think it was important for people to understand that it really began as a political identity and not so much an ethnic pride and ethnic identifier. So it was during, you know, the time of the late 60s, most of the Asians in America were primarily Japanese, Chinese, and Filipinos, and with some Koreans. As we, of course, identified as Japanese American, Chinese American, and Filipino American, we were small in number and pretty much overlooked in a society that was really rendered in black and white. Race relations and the U.S. in general, I think, is still identified in a polarization of black and white with Asians and Latinos and, well, American Indians kind of falling through the cracks in terms of belonging to this country. So that was really the main reason. And that so many of the people that were active, you know, in the late 60s into the 70s, you know, are now getting older, myself included. We are losing people. So I, you know, as we have always, as Asian Americans has always have had to do, is rely on our own oral histories, our own photographs, our own community to pass on the histories that are not taught in school. So I wanted to talk to as many people from this era, from the long 60s, as possible to get a to paint a broad panorama of the Asian American movement and the making of Asian America, but also to provide the personal interest and passions that made the movement. You know, a social movement doesn't make itself. There are people who, whether they're leaders or grunts, are the people who make something happen. So I wanted to really record and document those many, many voices, or at least some of the many voices that really made up the making of Asian America.
When did the shift from Oriental to Asian American happen, and for what reasons?
Well, I think this was part and parcel of what we wanted to do. I think that Oriental signified many things. One of not being American, being exotic, not belonging, of being stereotyped. There are so many stereotypes that were connected with the concept of Oriental, all the way from Fu Manchu to Charlie Chan. So the Orientalizing really kind of kept us, you know, sort of, you know, within a stereotypical range from as seen by the outside. And part of the shedding of that kind of one-dimensional stereotype to becoming a more multidimensional political entity. So the change from Oriental to Asian American really came about during this time. So if you see the very early organizations, they continued to use, they still use the term Oriental because that's all we had. So there was a group called Oriental Concern, Oriental Student Union up in Seattle. But I think very quickly after the Asian American Political Alliance in Berkeley in 68, the whole concept of Asian American in the terminology was found to be a lot more appropriate. You know, there was an emphasis on us being American and shedding some of the old stereotypes that went along with being Oriental. And I think, you know, naming itself has been very important in providing self-definitions. So just as the trajectory from Negro to Afro-American to African-American to Black, I think that we tried on, you know, many names as well. It started out sort of as a yellow power, I think after Black power, but I think it was after a while, it was really the Asian-American that stuck.
Amy Uematsu, she wrote a college paper with the title The Emergence of Yellow Power. You write that it became the most anthologized article on the Asian American movement. What did Uematsu contend in that paper?
You know, Amy, with The Emergence of Yellow Power, she really identified four main concepts that really kind of were the cornerstones of this sort of burgeoning movement's both intellectual and philosophical underpinning. So first was the concept of identity. Richard Aoki, who was both a Black Panther and an APA spokesman, he had indicated that, you know, Oriental is a rug and we are not Orientals, we're Asian Americans. So if you don't have your own identity, he was indicating, you really can't go on to own yourself and to exert your own power. So second notion that Amy identified was really that, just that, the power, you know, coming into power personally and politically, and that the sort of the normalization of inequality that was in the term Oriental, it had kind of led to an acquiescence on the part of Asian Americans to maintain sort of their minority status. Third was having a united front of being part of a third world revolution or third world solidarity. And I think that's really important, that it wasn't just Asians for Asians. You know, like I said, it was not really started out or intended to be an Asian pride, an ethnic pride, so much as a coalition and a standing with other people of color and recognizing our commonality and our common substrata within a white-dominated culture.
There were many debates, I understand, over whether the term Asian American should be hyphenated.
Yeah, I remember hearing it myself at the time, and people talked about that as well, you know, whether it should have a space or a dash. And it seems perhaps a bit trivial now, and I notice nowadays that so many people, and in so many articles, that Asian American is with a dash, as well as Japanese American, Chinese American, etc. And you know, at the time, we opted pretty much not to have that hyphenated, because you know it really suggests that, you know, Asians are never fully accepted. You know, there's always this discourse between Asian and American. And it really makes a bridge between two disparate identities, whereas we really thought of ourselves as, you know, a pretty holistic entity.
That's Karen Ishizuka. She is an award-winning documentary film producer and museum curator. She is also an author, and we're talking about her latest book. It's called Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s. It's published by Verso. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You locate the beginning of a nationwide Asian American movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s. What, in addition to this consensus around using the term Asian American, what else happened to get things going for this national movement?
So, you know, at the beginning, there was never one leader that went around the country proselytizing Asian America. I think that one of the interesting phenomena of this movement was what I call spontaneous arisings of people from different parts of the country at the same time, as well as different types of people. Now, I think that most Asian American studies and most of the times we think of the Asian American movement being a student movement. And certainly that is so. The 1968 Third World Strike, both at UC Berkeley and San Francisco State, were very much led in many ways by Asian Americans. That was a big watershed moment for other people seeing Asian Americans as a political force rather than just as Orientals, so to speak. But before that, there were people that the historian Eric Hobsbawm had called social bandits. They were basically street people who were hemmed in by social and economic forces that they didn't completely understand and which they had no control, but they knew that something was wrong. So it really started out as many of the gangs in Los Angeles, San Francisco, in New York. Those were sort of the precursors of activists who saw that Asian Americans were also discriminated against and not given a voice. So they did it from the streets, from the outside. You know, I quote, you know, Russell Valparaiso, who now lives in Hawaii, that, you know, he just felt that he says, when you're a minority, some people go backwards. They close their eyes to everything, but not me. I wasn't the kind of guy that was a bully, but I wasn't going to be pushed around. And he ends it by saying, we dreamed of being good gangsters. So, you know, in many ways, it was like the Robin Hood of the street code of taking care of your own, because they realized that they couldn't rely on the establishment to do that. So they were the precursors to the so-called activists that we know and that manifested as student activists.
For what purpose was a group called the Red Guard formed in San Francisco?
The Red Guard was a group in San Francisco. One of its leaders was Alex Heng, and he had left San Francisco Chinatown and really become politicized outside of Chinatown. And then he started reading Red Star Over China, the autobiography of Malcolm X. He went on the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C., and then said that what he wanted to do was go back to Chinatown and to organize the workers there in Chinatown. But then when he got there, he discovered that people that he was going to politicize had already formed a group called Leeways. They were a community-based organization of young people that were based in Chinatown. But then when Alex and other people joined Leeways, they eventually broke away to form a more revolutionary organization that was modeled after the Black Panthers. It was one of the very first of the Asian American leftist anti-imperialist organizations.
And you referred earlier to the young, the students who were instrumental, among other people, in kind of creating the momentum toward a full-fledged Asian American movement. The Asian American Political Alliance, or AAPA, was founded at UC Berkeley in 1968. What was the significance, what is the significance of that organization and what it was doing back then?
The Asian American Political Alliance, they call themselves APA, it was really the first group to unify under the banner of Asian American. One of the founders, Yuji Ichioka, had indicated that there were many solitary Asians out in political demonstrations, but there wasn't any attempt to organize them under the banner of Asian American. So they started that, and APA quickly became a vehicle, and there was never any formal chapters, but APA's Asian American Political Alliances started forming on campuses throughout the country, actually. But it was really an important organization that really gave, like I said, the words, you know, Asian American, and started identifying the reasons for the term Asian American.
The Third World Liberation Front strike, which you mentioned earlier, the one that took place at what is now San Francisco State University in 1968-69, was the longest campus strike in U.S. history, lasting for almost 5 months. Tell us about that strike and about the Asian American presence at that strike and what that meant for growing Asian American militancy.
The San Francisco Third World Liberation Front strike was a coalition of many students of color. There were African Americans, Latinos of various ethnicities, you know, the Asians of various ethnicities, and Native Americans. And the Asian American contingent actually was part of the leadership of that whole coalition. One of the things was that at the time, S.I. Hayakawa was part of the San Francisco State. So, in many ways, it was a clash of the old and the new in terms of what the whole concept of Asian Americans, you know, of towing the line versus struggling for more independence and more rights.
Right. Hayakawa was president of SF State at that time.
Right.
And as you write, he disliked ethnic-based organizations. He had a special dislike, I think you wrote, for Asian American activists. So this strike was about, as it was at UC Berkeley in 1969, it was about lack of diversity at the academy, right? It was about trying to bring in classes and a recognition of the third world, of third world peoples?
Yes, there was, you know, a lack of diversity in the academy, both in terms of classes and relevant education for people of color, you know, as well as faculty of color. So this was really the beginning of ethnic studies classes. And the whole concept of Asian American studies now had its beginnings during these strikes, both at San Francisco State and at Berkeley.
One thing that stands out in your account of the Third World Liberation Front strike at UC Berkeley in the first 3 months of 1969 was the enormous tension and violence that characterized that strike. You have one of the leaders, Belvin Louie, saying what about the atmosphere and about the kind of personal costs that he and his comrades had to endure?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I wanted to do throughout the book, was to go behind the facts and the figures of history and to really talk to people who made the history and what it was like in a day in and day out situation. So Belvin was really instrumental in helping me understand how difficult thinking that every day he would have to go out again as the tension mounted and as the oppression from the police mounted, you just never knew, you know, what was going to happen. So you're on the picket line, you know, day in and day out. And then in the evenings, they would really meet and talk about what had happened. But of course, you know, under those really emotional times, there was differences of opinions. So somehow they had to create a united front, whereas some people wanted to be more militant, some people wanted to be more compliant. So it really gave me, you know, an indication of how difficult it was just to be on the front lines. The post-traumatic stress disorder was first defined in 1980, you know, and although it primarily applied to soldiers in combat, it can be triggered by many types of events, traumatic events, as we know now. And, you know, Belvin had referred to the post-traumatic stress that that even after it was over, so many of them avoided Sproul Hall, where many of the arrests were made.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Karen Ishizuka is my guest. She is author of Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese-American Incarceration. She helped establish the Japanese-American National Museum in Los Angeles. She was part of the Asian-American movement in L.A., and we are talking about her latest book. It's called Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s. So, Karen, as you acknowledge in your book, many of the early activists were not young, were not students or student age, but were middle-aged folks. So tell us about the Asian Coalition for Equality in Seattle, which I think, according to one of its participants, who you quote in your book, was the first political advocacy group that crossed Asian ethnic lines.
Yes, you know, that was one of my most favorite finds in all the research that I did in writing the book. So I went up to Seattle and I talked with Phil Hayasaka. Phil is Nisei. I think, you know, he's in probably his late 80s, maybe early 90s now.
Nisei is a second generation Japanese American?
Yes, the second generation Japanese American was born here of immigrant parents. He went to camp during World War II, you know, one of the 10 concentration camps that the U.S. had set up for Americans of Japanese ancestry. So, you know, even though the U.S. was at war with Germany and Italy, it was only the Japanese that were rounded up en masse and put behind barbed wire for the duration of the war. So when Phil got out, he went back to Seattle, and he went into the insurance business, I believe, and he joined this community organization, the Jackson Street Community Council, you know, basically as a way to, as a potential business network. But he became so involved, he became the board member and then was eventually asked to be its executive director. And so he found himself the executive director of this nonprofit community organization that was on the cusp between, you know, black and white community. So he realized that the discrimination and racism in this country was not just a black and white issue, that, you know, as a Japanese American, he realized that the discrimination was there against Asians as well. But he did not want to have an organization that was just Japanese. And he really felt that it was important for the Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino communities in the area to come together in a united front in order to make a difference.
What did he have to do in terms of building ties among the different Asian American communities in Seattle? Because, as you write, there was some mistrust among and between these groups, right?
Yes, I think, you know, throughout the country that, you know, we had always grown up, you know, in separate ethnic communities, and there wasn't the broader coalition of Asian Americans as there is now. So there was a sense of difference that, you know, I'm not like them or they are not like me. But Phil saw the larger picture. So, you know, it took him 2 years, actually, of sort of heart-to-heart discussions with individuals in each group to talk to them about the need for this. And once it came together, it was really one of the forces that actually really politicized some of the younger people as well. They did some amazing things, like they joined the strike for construction workers, that black construction workers should be hired when they were not. They spoke up and spoke out in a way that communities, both within the Asian American community and the larger community, had never seen Asians speak out. So they, you know, were quite bold and blazed a trail that had not been done before at all. ACE, as they were called, Asian Coalition for Equality, became a very active organization and very outspoken. One of the things that really was so different about them that really intrigued me was that they were not young, so-called long-haired radicals. Most of them were not only middle-aged, they were middle class, and most of them were professionals. There were a lot of doctors, dentists, pastors. It was not just a young people's struggle. It was not just young people who were activists.
Yeah, and one thing that I find striking, and maybe you find less so because you're steeped in this activist history, is you have this group called Asian Coalition for Equality in Seattle that you've been talking about. And so they're kind of finding their voice, and he, Mr. Hayasaka, is bringing together people of different Asian ethnicities. And so, you know, you kind of would expect, or maybe you would forgive them, maybe that's not the right word, if they banded together and just really advocated for their own issues, right? Really focused on just what their constituencies, what their communities wanted. And yet for them to think beyond that in these early stages, relatively early stages of the Asian American movement, to think in terms of other people, blacks, other oppressed people of color, and uniting with them. I find that inspiring and actually reflects a very sophisticated political analysis about what's happening, not just to Asians, Asian Americans in this country, but other people.
Yes, you know, and I would really have to credit Phil for that. And I think that Phil's experience in the community of the and running the Jackson Street community, he was, because of his activity in Jackson Street, asked to become the first director of the Seattle's Human Rights Commission. And I think that, you know, at that time, probably, you know, because he was Asian American and not Black, to become the first director of the Seattle's Human Rights Commission, I think he was particularly savvy about how white racism affects all people of color. You know, one of ACE's first far-reaching activities was in the protests against the discrimination of Black and minority trainees on constructions. It developed into some violence that caught the media's attention. And actually, in the Seattle Times, there was an article that was titled, "Should Orientals Join Blacks in Racial Protest?" So, you know, this reflects what you were talking about as being, you know, very surprising. The opener of the article says, suddenly the Seattle Oriental is becoming identified with civil rights in the protest movement. And, you know, then this too, you know, in terms of naming and in terms of the change from Oriental to Asian American, they came upon the label and term Asian American independently of the Asian American Political Alliance, the student group at the University of California at Berkeley, because they knew that they didn't want to consider themselves Oriental because that fed into the same stereotypes that they were working against. So it was interesting to me to realize that, you know, it was at the same time in a different part of the country that the term even Asian American came up spontaneously. So I think this was indicative of how the whole concept of coming into one's rights and coming into one's self-definition and self-empowerment happened throughout the country with Asian Americans. You know, and of course, it was a global issue. It was a time of global self-definition of anti-colonialism. You can see how it was something that was happening all over the world, and Asian Americans were definitely just part of it.
That's the voice of Karen Ishizuka. We are talking about her latest book, Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Karen. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Karen Ishizuka is a documentary film producer. She is a museum curator. She is a third-generation American of Japanese descent who is part of the Asian American movement in Los Angeles. She's co-editor of Mining the Home Movie, Excavations in Histories and Memories. And her latest book, which we are talking about today, is called Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s, and it's published by Verso. And Filipinos, they had an interesting and somewhat turbulent, at least at the beginning, relationship with the term Asian Americans. Did they feel comfortable within that movement?
I think that that was, and I think it continues to be, something that we need to be very understanding of and aware and of, where it's not just East Asians anymore that are the majority of Asian Americans in this country. So, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book, and I think that is important to understand, is that Filipinos themselves, you know, didn't consider themselves Asians and weren't part of that whole orientalizing in many ways. And yet they, of course, were very much felt the same discrimination and racism of white supremacy. It had been something that had been written about very early on. There was even a book later by Fred Cordova in Seattle, who called his book Filipinos, the Forgotten Asian Americans. You know, one of the main reasons was that that they were so different in history was that they had been a subjugated colony, you know, first of Spain and then of the United States for some 400 years. So, you know, they were really, you know, we felt ourselves as internally colonized in the United States, but they were actually colonized subjects. And so they were really, they had really different federal categories over the years that really stripped them of much of their identity as either Filipinos or Americans. They were considered U.S. nationals, which, you know, meant that they owed allegiance to the United States, but they didn't have the rights of citizens. So they were in this really trying and very different status of being neither citizen nor alien, so to speak. And yet the Philippine Army was incorporated into the U.S. Army. So the Filipinos really have, you know, a really important history in and of themselves. They were definitely part of an Asian American movement, but something that I think forced and challenged all of us to expand even the concept of Asian American to become Asian Pacific Islanders. So, you know, in the late 60s, it's really API rather than Asian American was a much more accurate term to reflect the inclusion of Filipinos, Samoans, Tongans, Guamanians, other Pacific Islanders.
Let's spend some time, Karen, on the iHotel, the International Hotel. This is one of the legendary struggles in Asian American movement history. It was a 9-year battle to save the International Hotel, which stood in what used to be San Francisco's Manila Town. And I like this example, this struggle as well, because it shines a light on some of the politically radical Asian American formations that you address and cover in this book. So maybe we can begin with what happened in terms of plans to demolish this International Hotel, who lived in it, who were Asian American, and what happened to the structure?
Yeah, it really was a very iconic, extremely important struggle within both the Asian American history as well as the history of the greater San Francisco Bay Area. The iHotel had been in existence from very early on and was really the home for bachelor Chinese and Filipino men who, you know, at that time when they came to the United States, they weren't allowed to marry outside of their race. There were anti-miscegenation laws that basically rendered a lot of Asian men to be single for the rest of their lives. So many of the occupants were these older Asian men who had no families. So it was a place that they called home. That was really their home. Like many Manila towns, Chinatowns, J-towns across the country, big business and cities began to gentrify the area, and the I Hotel, the International Hotel, was scheduled for demolition. It created a lot of support from the varying surrounding communities, and especially from young people at that time, because it happened just about the same time after the strikes. And it was something that the Asian American Studies really emphasized, was a connection to community and not just being in the ivory tower of the academy. So it was something that really a lot of different people rallied around, both older people and younger people. And also it did gain the support of the different and often feuding leftist organizations at that time.
Yeah, tell us about maybe two or three of the political formations that were involved in defending or trying to defend the hotel, and what their disagreements were.
You know, there were quite a few organizations at that time. You know, one was the KDP, and I cannot pronounce it in Tagalog, but basically it was the Union of Democratic Filipinos. There was another organization called Iwokun, IWK, and another called Wei Minshe. And those were three pre-party sort of formations that actually had connections to the I Hotel. The I Hotel, the bottom floor, was open to a lot of organizations, not just political ones, but also cultural, artistic organizations as well. So each of these political organizations had different kinds of understandings. And, you know, I would... It's very complex and it's not easily summarized. I think that, you know, it just had a lot to do with their own philosophy and ideology, and therefore how it played out on the ground. But I think that it provided an arena where some of their own political ideas clashed with the overall concept of saving the hotel. So I think that there was a lot of struggles that went on between and amongst the organizations. But I think that they all came together in terms of, you know, wanting self-definition and self-empowerment for their communities. So the hotel was eventually demolished. It was torn down. However, they maintained the land and the commitment to rebuild for 30 years, because they really wanted to eventually build, and they guarded it against any development that did not include affordable housing. So they eventually coalesced with the Catholic Center that was there, the HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, a city, to resurrect and open a new international hotel, senior housing, and community center to serve the people in the area.
Well, we've really been talking just about two or two and a half chapters of this book by my guest, Karen Ishizuka. It's called Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s. So there's much more for people to learn by reading the rest of this book. What is your sense, Karen, of where the Asian American movement stands today? I know that's a big question, but I'm sure a lot of people are curious based on the historical perspective you can bring and the personal historical perspective you can bring to Asian America, what you feel like Asian America and the Asian American movement is, constitutes, and is able to do and could potentially do in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, I think even though I wrote this book, and I think it's important to remember the 60s, the long 60s, and all that happened, you know, it wasn't an attempt to go back to the 60s. You know, that it doesn't exist anymore, and neither should it. You know, I think that social movements were not meant to last. They need to reflect the current and surrounding issues and constituencies, and that requires new ways and new strategies. Now, I think that two things that Asian Americans still, even though the demographics have changed tremendously, both in class and the variety of ethnicities, you know, I think that basically APIs still, though, are seen as a model minority, and also, you know, as foreigners in their own country. So these, I think, are misconceptions, stereotypes that are still with us, even though we have tried very hard to enlighten people about that. So, you know, given that, I think that the lessons, it's hard to say, but I think, you know, in those days, you know, we had the concept of third world solidarity. And, you know, now I think that solidarity coalitions, and it has become known as allyships. But I think that's more important than ever. I don't think that we can isolate ourselves as just Asian Americans, APIs. And I think this shows in organizations and issues and strategies like Asians for Black Lives, the Asians that had gone to Wounded Knee in the day have made themselves allies with the water and the pipeline. And I think that, you know, we just need to find the commonalities and the common denominators. So I think, you know, at this point, you know, that we need to reach out and make a strong resistance to the inequities that we see. We see that it's not against any one race or ethnicity. So I think we each have to be activists in our own way. And I think that another big lesson that I learned from doing this book was my good friend Chris Ijima, who had passed away, who was part of the singing group Chris and Joanne and Charlie. He said that one thing he learned from his activist parents was that you can be an activist and a normal person at the same time. So I think that's what I would like for people to think about, how they can also be an activist as well as a normal person at the same time.
Karen Ishizuka, documentary film producer, museum curator. She wears a lot of hats. She's author of Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese American Incarceration. We've been talking about her latest book, Serve the People, Making Asian America in the Long 60s. Karen, thanks for writing this book, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, CS. I'm delighted that you asked me, and quite honored.
And I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. And we turn now to a short clip from an audio documentary produced in 1959 by Marshall Windmiller at radio station KPFA in Berkeley. The documentary is called The Japanese in California, and it consists of the voices of a number of Japanese Americans talking about their lives in the U.S. One of those people, who, like most of the rest in this documentary, goes unidentified, spoke, and again, this is in 1959, about what he and others did and what they chose not to do after Japan entered World War II and after Franklin Roosevelt signed in 1942 Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment of about 120,000 Japanese Americans. Here's what he said.
In 1940, I think we slowly began to realize that what Japan was doing in Manchuria and China did reflect upon us. And I remember in Los Angeles, we set up a speakers bureau. That was 1940. You see, we could see that people identified us with Japan and the people of Japan. So we set up a speakers bureau, going to speak to church groups, women's clubs, service organizations, as many as we could cover, outlining our position that we were Americans, our loyalty was to America, that to us Japan was a foreign country, you see. That was, of course, we realized we're American citizens, and when this talk about evacuating us came up, we didn't take it too seriously at first. We said, well, they couldn't evacuate us. We're American citizens, you see. But it happened. And even today, people ask us, how could that be possible? Because being citizens, you see, we have certain rights. In fact, there was a lot of talk at the time, even when evacuation became quite definite, as to what course we should take, whether we should fight for our rights and stay on the West Coast, or whether we should cooperate with the government and its program of evacuating us from the West Coast. And I would say that the primary consideration in all this thing, as far as we are concerned, is the fact that our parents, not being able to become American citizens, they were aliens ineligible for citizenship. So overnight they became enemy aliens, you see, through no fault of their own. We could hardly say, well, we're going to fight to stay here. We're Americans. We don't care what happens to our parents, you see. And that was, I think, the biggest factor that helped us determine what our course would be. Of course, there again, although we saw it differently, other people felt that our taking all this was almost an admission of some close relationship with the people of Japan.
And that's from an audio documentary produced in 1959 called The Japanese in California. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.